Thank you so much for your talk. I think I'm going to start with a general question, one that I think holds significance for both artists and critics. And the question recurs in many discussions concerning contemporary wars and conflicts. For example, you yourself open your book, Hiroshima After Iraq, by quoting Maurice Blanchot's observation that political impatience makes criticism warlike. And my question is one about the political consequence of style. So I wanted to ask you, should the main goal, not only of art, but also of criticism, be to develop a style, visual, verbal, which wouldn't reproduce the rhetoric of war? And here I actually wanted to point to, just by way of example, to another essay by Blanchot under the telling title, Apocalypse is Disappointing. The essay is a polemic with Karl Jaspers, who in 1956 wrote that with the invention of nuclear weapons, we have entered a new era where for the first time humanity can destroy itself with one entirely. And thus, Jaspers says, a radical change in humanity is necessary. And what's interesting for me is that Blanchot's criticism concerns precisely Jaspers' style. He says that Jaspers calls for radical change, but simultaneously repeats the same language, concentrating, for example, on political changes during the Cold War. So he calls for radical change without renewing his language, using the same metaphors, for example. So my question would be to repeat it again, what kind of critical style and language does the process of un-war or peacemaking require?
So you mean visual language?
I'm thinking both visual, but actually verbal as well, in the sense of thinking of critics and of scholars.
Okay, well, I think it's a huge question you're asking, but I would say, first of all, we have to answer the question of what is a rhetoric of war, you know, what counts as a warlike rhetoric that you might want to avoid. I would say, though, that a first step, yes, I do, my answer is yes. But we have to decide what is warlike, right? I mean, we don't mean that passion is warlike, you know, we want passion, and this is certainly a passionate project. Passionate project. I think that the first step, and one that I think was taken by many artists during the postmodern period, would be to destroy the monological voice in some way, or to interrupt the monological voice with what Craig Owens famously called the discourse of others. So I think that is a major step away from a violent rhetoric or language. So I think, if to bring it back to this is a project that is about incorporating a whole multiplicity of voices.
Have one more question then, which is also general actually, but it is in fact maybe about the process of generalization itself. Because what strikes me in...
Yes.
Sorry. I just thought of this, as you were asking the question, I kept thinking of Audre Lorde's famous line, right, the master's tools cannot demolish the master's house, which has become, you know, a famous saying not to use the same kinds of language. And I've often, you know, much as I want to get into the spirit of that, I've often thought that's not true. You know, on a metaphorical level, a master's tools could demolish a master's house, right? So I think it really is, I should have said that first before I started talking about different tools, but I think it is a really complex question that because I think there are a lot of ways to try to. I don't think there's just a single way.
Well, in a sense, when we think about this project, it also uses similar tools. I mean, it uses also a huge architectonic structure that kind of is semi-transparent, so it doesn't try to eradicate the monument itself, but it
builds over it.
So it's not the master's tools, you're saying?
No.
Or it is the master's tools, or it's both?
It's both.
And it's also, by the way, because Vidichko insists that this project is meant to be realized, he's also designed it, and I think this was a change at some point in the project, so that it can be taken down and then put up again, so it can be treated as a temporary structure.
But what strikes me about this project, and you actually mentioned this also in your talk, is in a way it's universalism. And I'm wondering whether we can actually speak about a culture of war, or whether necessarily we always have to speak about cultures of war. And I think Vodichko in a sense would agree, because at the end of his book, The Abolition of War, he actually does analyze a very specific example, and that's the Polish nationalist patriotic rhetoric and narrative. So I'm wondering also whether the art practices that are that should be dealing with war, should be implementing this new un-war narrative, whether they also should be, in a sense, site-specific.
Well, I think what I said at the end of my talk speaks to part of your, is a partial answer to your question, because it's what I'm making an argument that is that this is about building a international anti-war culture, so it would be universal in that sense, right? But it's one that would incorporate multiplicities, or he wants to model it on the Mouffian notion of democratic agonism. But also, your question brings up that whole, I hesitate to raise it, the whole problem of psychoanalysis, because I do believe there are certain universal structures in terms of subjectivity. And I think that, as Slavoj Žižek wrote many years ago, that in the rush to historicize, we shouldn't ignore those possibilities, just as in the rush to universalize, we shouldn't ignore particularity. The reverse is also true. So I think that the psychoanalysis, even though, you know, those structures of subjectivity interact and change with different social and economic and political periods.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I would like to ask you about the issue you touched upon in your talk. And so I have two questions. So I would like to ask you about the relation between the un-war culture and agonistic democracy. Because I think that un-war culture somehow counters the whole rage of violence, first of all. But I wonder, how is the relation between un-war culture and conflict, or how this passage looks like from the conflict-driven agonistic democracy to un-war culture?
Yeah, good question. I think that we can't equate war with conflict in the sense of democratic conflict, but I think also we have to take, and I stress this in the talk, the ineradicability of violence in us. So the question is really how to have institutions that will in some way, what are we going to do with that violence, right? And that's the reason, one of the reasons for institutions other than the one that I mentioned before. So I think they're really actually very compatible, the UNWAR conflict-driven institution, because it's about recognizing conflict but allowing it to express itself in a different way.
Because conflict also produces anxiety, and anxiety can produce violence.
Yes.
So I think about this.
Well, that's exactly what Fornari is talking about, that war was actually a way of resolving the problem of anxiety. But, you know, then he says, but in nuclear war, it no longer functions that way. So we need a new institution. If we want to do away with war, we need a new institution that will also resolve anxiety. And that, for him, was the Omega Institution. And he has a whole, he never really fully develops the way in which it will resolve anxiety. But he has some idea about law, because it's a juridical institution, that law resolves anxiety in the sense that it provides an outside person who says you can, an outside figure, authority, that says you cannot do that, you cannot act on that. And that that is a resolution of anxiety too, according to him.
So considering art practices, art practices, shall they rather transgress conflict or trigger conflict, or both?
What do you mean by transgress conflict?
I'm thinking about, well, I don't know really, because most of art practices, they are very warlike, and they aim at triggering conflict. So I wonder what would be the alternative, because, you know, most of the projects I have in mind, such as, I don't know, the most spectacular, like Santiago Sierra or Artur Zmijewski in Poland, they seem to be very warlike. So conflict-driven and conflict-triggering. I mean, the conflict that kind of puncturing social body, which is...
I mean, revealing conflicts within a seemingly monolithic body. That to me, the concealment of conflict under the appearance of harmony and unity is a recipe for violence. The, you know, it's the repression of conflict. So I think that practices, that anti-war practices that might want to promote an un-war culture, I don't think they have to deal with the topic of war at all. I mean, I think of the feminist practices of the 80s, that arose in the 80s, like Barbara Kruger's work, was very much about an aggressive interrogation of the viewing subject. But it was to hopefully invite the viewer to examine those impulses in him or herself. So, and I mean aggressive here, not in the sense of obliterating the identity of someone else, but just in the sense of being forceful. And also in the sense of moving toward the viewer, rather than remaining a distanced aesthetic object like that someone like Michael Fried or Clement Greenberg wanted or believed art should be.
Okay, so just one more question. I'm thinking about art history and maybe wider about humanities today, and considering UNWAR project, UNWAR sketch, which is utopia in a good sense of this word, I think. I mean, what are the responsibilities of art history in building this UNWAR culture?
It's interesting, you know, when you think about what are the responsibilities of history, larger history in the sense of the writing of history or the narrating of history. And the historian, Dominique Le Capra, I don't know if you've read his work, but... that's great. Yeah, well, he talks a lot about this, you know, what it means to write history and what are the obligations. And so your question makes me think, because he feels that the, one of the obligations is to work through, that, that history should work through the traumas, the historical traumas that it's writing about. That that's, and he means it in a psychoanalytic sense. So you could say the same for art history, is why I'm bringing this up, that that art history, which is a history, which is a form of history, might also consider that as an obligation. And also because art has been so tied up with war, you know, with glorifying war. I mean, it's been, there have also been, you know, wonderful critiques of war in art, like, you know, Goya or whatever, but I think, and then if you get even less superficial than the content of art, but art has been one of the cultural practices in the modern period that has worked to produce what I consider a warlike subject, right? And a subject that sees itself as autonomous, that sees itself as invulnerable, that therefore has to suppress difference, has to suppress otherness in order to maintain that fantasy. I think war has been one of, war, art has been one of the biggest culprits in the production of that subject. The heroic, you know, artist, the autonomous artist, the divine artist, are all warlike artists.
So in that sense, art should also be responsible for redeeming or for kind of getting us out of that situation.
Yeah, because I think that more recently, art has, a kind of art has developed that actually addresses its subject and questions that subject, asks the subject to question itself, and to, you know, one of my favorite quotes from Gayatri Spivak is when she defined post-structuralism as a radical acceptance of vulnerability. And I think that art has been part of that post-structuralist and feminist attempt to create a subject that it, that accepts vulnerability rather than constructs itself as the mastering subject.
Before I hand over the mic to the audience, I have one more question regarding the project itself. What struck me when Louisa was asking the question about triggering art as a trigger of conflicts is that Vodichko's project seems to put a lot of faith, perhaps too much faith, that would be a provocative question, in kind of precisely deliberation and education and knowledge. Because from what it seems, the structure itself is kind of an educational platform surrounding that is supposed to explain parts of the monument and list all wars, et cetera, et cetera. And as I understand, a part of the project would also be the veteran projections, or a way of kind of enlivening.
No, they're part of this project, okay, but so they're ancillary works that he's done.
So, but kind of this method or this project would, as I said, kind of put faith in the fact that showing war or kind of to the public and in a sense of listing the atrocities would simultaneously act towards the end of war or be an active kind of component of peacemaking.
You mean there's a certain faith in reason? I think there is in part, because I think to the extent that it's a didactic institution, it's also one dedicated to debate, which is a whole other, but that's also has to do with reason. I guess I would place it in a kind of Adornian light, in that, you know, Adorno was this, was a big critic of Enlightenment reason, because of the way it was tied up from the very start with domination and the way in which it developed toward greater and greater, you know, disaster for that reason, domination of nature, domination of the internal person. But he didn't reject reason, right? I mean, he wanted reason to be put in the service of what it was originally supposed to be put in the service of, which would be emancipation. So I think, you know, maybe, I hadn't really thought of this, although I did get a question a little similar, not as good as your question, but from somebody that about this, about the didactic aspect of it. But I haven't really thought about it, but as you ask it, I think maybe this project could be placed in that framework. You know, it's not, it certainly doesn't reject reason, but it's, you know, it rejects certain aspects of the way reason has historically developed. I don't think that's really using the master's tools, because I'm not sure that reason itself is a master's tool. It's the way in which reason was, first of all, universalized and, as I said, you know, put, tied up with the domination of nature. Maybe it's a master's tool.
So let's open this up.
Thanks. There's this great quote from Annie DiFranco that opens Empire: every tool is a weapon if you hold it right. So it's a question of holding it right, not if it's master's or. Thanks for the inspiring talk. It's really, I completely share this goal of abolishing war and creating an unwar project. One thing that I find somehow problematic in this narrative, and I say this for the sake of advancement of the argument, is that this analysis you provided is very idealistic. I mean, in philosophical sense of the word idealistic, as opposed to materialist or more concrete. Psychoanalysis here is a good example of this problem, and I'm not against psychoanalytic discourse or psychoanalytic language. I'm against using psychoanalysis as the only language of describing the problem. So, and the question of violence really shows very well what is this problem, because definitely violence is necessary for war. However, we should not violence does not equal war. War is a special institutional form of expressing violence.
Yes.
And if we put this in a historical and materialist perspective, then I believe we can somehow move forward. Because actually, for 90% of its history, humanity did not know wars. War is an invention of Neolithic revolution. And it's interesting to ask, why is it so? Because actually, Neolithic revolution, because of new property relations, makes war sensible. I mean, it makes sense to wage wars, as opposed to what the way people lived before the Neolithic Revolution. Now, if you look at contemporary times, it's not only the atom bomb that changed the situation. It has been remarked many times by political scholars, although I think not a lot of them really draw enough conclusions from this fact, is that there has never ever been a war between two parliamentary democracies. And I'm not saying this to fetishize parliamentary democracy, but I think it's really, it shows something about the nature of war and about situation when it's worth to wage a war. Because parliamentary democracy is accompanying certain form of social economic development that makes war very problematic, because precisely it's the same thing as the atom bomb. It's very difficult to win, right? If you imagine war between France and Germany now, whoever wins, like, both sides are losing, because both sides lose so much in the terms of development, infrastructure, and so on. So I think we should put more emphasis on this materialistic and historical character of war, and to the question that actually the whole project is not really giving us a response to, an answer, is why actually wars tend to disappear in certain situations and appear in different situations. Like the US is waging a lot of wars, but all these wars are with states that have different political and social organizations, right? And this fact that there has never ever been a war between two parliamentary democracies. I think this kind of questions we should maybe be asking more than exploring the subjective psychoanalytical conditions for war?
First of all, I was at pains in my talk to say and to quote Frenari saying that it's not a matter of replacing other explanations for war, but for shifting an emphasis from those that have been widely discussed to those that have not, the psychoanalytic explanation, because the psychoanalytic approach to the phenomenon of war is not the only one. And I feel like I really tried hard to make that point in this piece. But it is not one that has predominated by any means the way the historical materialist one has predominated. So this is a plea, my talk, for something else to be heard that hasn't been. Now for Frenari, so it's not a matter of the psychoanalytic discourse repressing other discourses. It's been quite the other way around. The other thing I wanted to say, if I can remember it, let me think. Well, you know, you're right that war is not violence. And I agree it has to be treated as a specific social institution. That means that when there are economic conflicts, ideological conflicts, political conflicts, when they're expressed in the form of war, then something new has come into existence that has to be explained. And I think the psychoanalytic approach offers something that needs to be part of that explanation, because for one thing, psychoanalysis, so far as I know, is the only well-developed theory of cruelty that we have.
Thank you. I have a couple of remarks and one question, I guess. I would like to start by saying that I cannot help thinking that it looks like La Défense there. And it disturbs me a little bit, because you know that going like ahead further from Arc de Triomphe, you have La Défense, and back you have the Pyramid of Louvre. That means, you know, when you take it together, there is an actually a kind of axis of well, evil, no evil, but a certain kind of colonization of by La Défense of the, what I would say, more traditional Paris architecture. But it's just an association. I would like to add to this association a story, which is, I've been there like 10 days ago, and it was just after the match when France won over Ukraine and qualified to World Cup. And what was surprising is that, that all around the Arc de Triomphe were people with flags, Algerian flags, celebrating, saying Vive l'Algérie, etc. So I would say it was a triumph of a kind, but a very conflictual one. You know, that in the center of this, as you said, patriotic and a bit nationalistic monument, you had a conflictual political demonstration. I got to know just afterwards that Algeria too qualified to World Cup. So that was a reason. I thought at the beginning that they are celebrating France qualification in this way, which is, again, very, very interesting. And it's interesting also because this place is between the tourists, very, very tourist part of Paris, which is Champs-Élysées, and the more or more, one of the most expensive and rich districts, which is 16th. So I think I'm saying it just to point out that even this monumental form is still very vulnerable. It can acquire a very, very different kinds of practices. So that was one remark, maybe a bit superficial. But my actual question, and maybe a point of disagreement even, is a little bit connected with what Janek and Luisa said about the concept of war. I had the impression that it a little bit comprises every kind of conflict. My question would be, what a relation would you establish between war and struggle? Because I guess I wouldn't like to have a culture of unstruggle. It's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying for me. And I'm also a little bit anxious about the concept of unwar, because if it suggests as an absence of tensions, you know, you said it was William James' quote, I guess. I'm sorry if I misquote you, but of course it's also a statement by Kant that, you know, peace normally is just a tiny break between wars and a strategic one, etc., etc. I kind of like this definition because it's very, very true. And I'm more afraid about the vision of peace, which would be really perpetual. I think there is something uncanny in it. And the very notion of unwar, a very negative definition, which is very abstract at the same time, means to me an absence of conflict. And the first association, psychoanalytic association I have with this, is death drive. Death drive, because it is exactly an abstract strive for the absence of conflicts. So my question is first, struggle and war, what kind of relations? And, you know, I would also ask for more concrete image, even, maybe, not definition, but image of this, what is hidden under this unwar concept? What is that? Is it the cosmopolitan, non-tension culture, or what kind of
I don't think
imaginary stands for it? Sorry. Thank
you. First of all, the war and struggle, I think that's a very good question, because it's raising the question of pacifism and the pacifism's relationship to wars of liberation, let's say, which is something that we want to support. So I think the, is this a pacifist project? Not in the sense that it claims to that there are peaceful people who want to abolish war, because it argues that in fact there are not such people at all. I suppose that the wars of liberation, the anti-colonialist struggles, would be a case, or World War II even, right? Might be a case where there are wars that one would support. Still, in terms of the historical hope that I referred to at the end, it would be a hope that there would be an institution that would find other means, that this institution might be, we don't know what would happen in this institution, but there might be an anti-colonialist component, because that is what has caused so many horrible wars, from both the side of the colonizer and then the struggle against the colonizer. So I think all kinds of things could happen in here. I thought about, what if the raped women of Congo came to the World Institute for the Abolition of War wanting military intervention? I think these are all the kinds of questions that would come up, that hopefully would come up in this institution. In terms of this being La Défense, I don't see that at all. I mean, maybe there's some visual relationship, I don't know. But it's certainly not an institution that, this one.
Is it up there?
Yeah. It's not an institution that claims, I think, that claims to reconcile conflict in some universal harmony. that kind of harmony that is about concealing actual conflicts that exist. I mean, that did seem to me to be a superficial comparison. Your idea that monuments are vulnerable without something like this, you're absolutely right. It's because they're vulnerable that artists can do things like this. It's because they're unstable. It's because they're built on repressions. It's because they have no absolute foundations of meaning. It's because meaning is produced through relationships with context that we're able to use them this way, that we don't have to knock them down the way the Paris Commune did, though that was great, right? But we don't have to destroy the monument that way. We can be Charlie Chaplin in City Lights destroying the monument, which, you know, coming down from that, I don't know if you've ever seen that, but the monument is vulnerable. Power suffers. That's the premise.
No, my goal was to say that these gatherings are efficient because they're not institutionalized. I think that these people would never go to such an institution.
Why not?
Because it's institution.
They would never.
And they feel a bit awkward with institutionalized forms of even help. Come on, it's France. You know, there are plenty of things to, you know, activate them,
okay,
which they don't care of.
Yeah, but I don't think there's really any outside of institutions, but maybe there are people who wouldn't go there. I don't know. Maybe you could build it in a way or construct it in a way. I don't want to be put in the position of defending this project. I think it's an interesting project. It raises all kinds of interesting questions. And that's it's art. It's not... It's sort of art. It's different things. Sure, there are problems.
Sure. I just like to make a little remark to what Pavel was saying and to Bodichko project and this question of knowledge, because this is something that really troubles me. And it is an educational institution, I mean, the project of in part. But what is the other part? And I also thought about the psychoanalytic model of subjectivity, the warlike subject. So what is the other part of the subject? And I thought about, why do we exist as civilization? Not because we are warlike, but because we are empathic. So I, love, empathy, and so on. So I thought that, the other part of this project that, for me, would need a kind of development would be something Chantal Mouffe is also touching upon in her books, passions, and maybe other knowledge, other kind of knowledge, like cultivating empathy or whatever, I don't know. Okay, we are waiting for questions.
So I have one remark about the remarks and the other question. The remark about the remarks would be that I think that most of the questions tend come into one direction. And I think that we collectively feel that the word wall is somehow not enough. I think that most of the remarks and questions point into this one thing, that maybe if it would be Institute of Against Domination of Repression, then it would, include more areas that we think and we feel are crucial and important. And just this thing that unwarring is not enough. Undominating and unrepressing is what would be more sufficient. And the other thing, it is somehow connected to this question, because I just kept on wondering, would that be an institution with somehow a petrified program, or the visitors would have way to changing, modeling it, therefore making it a more participant institution?
In regard to your second question, I never saw it as a petrified institution because he's never provided any kind of permanent or absolute program for it. The program is all suggestive because it's something that would need to be constructed by participants. So, but in terms of your first question, I think it's a really interesting idea that institute against domination and repression might be, and I think that the gist of your question is that it would be more political in that way, and that addressing war somehow is a more a depoliticizing concept in some way because of the problem of so-called, you know, well, wars of liberation, things that people have raised here. I still think that maybe I'm being, I would assume that issues of domination and repression would be like one of the main things on the agenda of the World Institute for the Abolition of War, because I don't really think you can separate war from that drive to dominate. But, you know, the question of whether to isolate war as an institution that needs to be addressed apart from, I don't want to say apart from specificity, because you do want to always talk about it in relation to specific situations, but whether war is a phenomenon that can be addressed. As I said before, I think it really is something different. War is a phenomenon because of its enduringness, how it is endured, that it is a phenomenon that is different from other kinds of other ways that conflict comes out.
Hello. I would like to go a little bit farther with some of the comments and some of the observations that were made, and propose a kind of a practical open proposition in reaction to what I see and what I experience. I'm curious if you would be interested in thinking about this project as a hypothetical hypothetical program for a real development, a program but not a solution. I appreciate the proposal that Mr. Modishko is suggesting, but I would like to think about this project as a continuation of a long history of architectural projects that were in earlier 20th century, and especially as a result of the First World War, there were more than a few architectural competitions calling for anti-war and peace and friendship institutions. These were actual architectural competitions, in those competitions quite a few architects participated. They were never realized, but they did it, they did practice. So I would like to think about this project as a project in the line of those type of projects, and try to think about this as an open project which could create a situation for this type of discussions. And I was curious if you would be interested in actually participating, and if Mr. Bodichko would like to. He is more than welcome because he's part of the critical history. And invite other people to actually create a competition brief without a site, without a specific context. I think about people who could possibly be involved. When I see the image here on the wall, I definitely think about Maya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial, who I think is an antithesis to what we see. So I'm just curious.
Could you say more about that? About Maya Lin being the antithesis of this?
Well, first of all, you know, I don't know if I should mention about the competition that was held and how it came about. But I think it would be easier for you to actually probably talk about the context of that. But first, I would like to mention that the psychoanalytical part of your presentation definitely fits very well with Maya Lin's project, which is definitely, you know, I think on the other side of the spectrum. I don't want to monopolize, and I don't have any quotes, I don't have any names. So I just think basically about the practical take and actually creating this into an open project, not a closed project with a building, with a structure, with no meaning inside and with no purpose and with no sponsorship, with no PR agencies and so on.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think what you propose is really interesting. And I definitely would be interested in that. I think that thinking of this, not as a solution, but as, I forget what word do you use?
Open problem.
Is a great way to look at it, absolutely. I think that is the way I look at it. I don't think Vidichko, or certainly not, I don't conceive of this as a solution. You know, I'm not an idiot. You know, it's part of a vast amount of anti-war work. In terms of Maya Lin, I'm intrigued by I really wanted to know why you thought Maya Lin was the antithesis, because when the Maya Lin Vietnam Memorial was first put up, I'm sure as you know, it caused a great deal of controversy, and they had to put up a realistic war memorial right nearby, you know, at a bronze, you know, traditional thing, because there was so much objection to Maya Lin's, which was read as an anti-war memorial. It's a war memorial that was an anti-war memorial because it was a memorial. The experience of entering the memorial is the experience of death. So it was war as death rather than war as victory and all these patriotic things. I think that's changed over the years as that memorial, the meanings have just become, you know, sort of ossified. But I think at the beginning, it certainly wasn't the same as this, and there are huge problems with it since it was only, the only people that are honored there are the U.S. soldiers who died, and the Vietnamese are completely excluded. But more or less, at least in somewhat in the spirit of this, at the beginning, I wouldn't say so anymore, probably because it's the problem of permanence.
First of all, I would like to thank you for your lecture and actually for some of the arguments you provided me today for being even more critical about the project of Vidichko. In a sense that I'm referring to your reference to Kant and his project for perpetual peace in Europe or in the universe. There were many projects like that, and actually maybe nobody today reads a very old-fashioned American historian Carl Becker, but he was one of those who ridiculized those late Enlightenment projects for perpetual peace in the whole world. And this is actually this probably the strongest point which I wanted to refer to, in a way that this project looks like and it tends to return late Enlightenment utopia in a way. And I think that your point about the localization on the axis of La Défense, it's a very important issue, I mean, to me, because again, we have a project. We wanted to have a faith in the critical powers of the critical art in public spaces. And here, we have again this kind of centralized vision, you know, in the capital of the, you know, one of the global most important states. Then my question is, so where there is a place for this kind of really critical powers in this particular project? Because for me, like, this Enlightenment utopia for the perpetual, you know, kind of peacemaking is, if we try to get back to those ideas, this cosmopolitan idea doesn't help in today's war politics, because we never experienced the Third World War, but the problem of the local conflicts or local wars actually are the most important. And here we are getting back to this kind of central monument which is criticized. So I'm asking about for example, taking this project as an example, what would be the critical powers of this kind of projects in public spaces? And just one question about the war memorial. I'm very, very aware of the ideas that most of war memorials are not located in the place when war atrocities actually took place. Mm-hmm. So the Vietnam memorial is the case. So this is the case. How?
Yeah.
Where are the critical powers about this problem?
Well, first of all, Kant was definitely not the first to suggest perpetual peace. In fact, his essay is built on the earlier essay of some abbot, I forget his name, who wrote a proposal for perpetual peace. In terms of this being a utopian Enlightenment project, as I said, I don't think that it's utopian. I think it's Enlightenment. It partakes of the Enlightenment, as I said, this particular aspect of Enlightenment, the demand for justice and equality for all, that part of Enlightenment universalism. I don't think it is part of the other aspects of the Enlightenment. So I think we have to really be careful when we talk about Enlightenment and not just pull a lever, yes, for Enlightenment or against. You know, it's a very complex issue. In terms of the site, hold on, I just want to make sure I got all the aspects of what you said. In terms of its site, I've heard other objections to the site, that it should be put somewhere else, not in the center. But I think the fact that it is in the center of power, which is the source of so much of the violence, is actually is important in a lot of ways, rather than it being somewhere else. I think because it's addressing. It's addressing this site as a site of power, as the center of power, but trying to counter the site in that way, in that regard.
Okay, thank you for all your questions. And I think it's time to end. Thank you for your lecture, Lucien. Thank you.